crouch, bind, set.
Joe presents the House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of House of Rugby, brought to you by Joe, together with our very good friends at Guinness. The Lord and the Hoff are settled back comfortably once again into their nests, but it's an exciting one this week. It is not often that we get genuine legends of the game on. Actually, that's not true. We've had a lot of legends of the game on, but I think this guy sits at the very top of the tree. 100 caps for Oz, 2 World Cup finals, super rugby star, playing his rugby all over the world, 3 European Cups. And I always want to say your name in a proper Australian accent. I don't know why, but it's a very good evening to Matt Giddow.
Thanks for having me. I like it.
There are certain players who will forever be sort of introduced in their native tongue. It's like Dan Catter is Dan Catter, and you are Matt Giddow. You're like Matt Gitto doesn't really work as well. I don't know. Maybe that's an English thing.
I think in France, they want to adopt it as a French name because it is French. So I prefer your Aussie Giddow, though. I like that.
Were you Mathieu Giddow in France? Was that a sort of flamboyant way to introduce yourself?
Pretty simple, Matt. I think because no one's Australian over there, so you want to keep your uniqueness. When I come back here, I'm Mathieu. When I'm in France, I'm Matt Giddow.
Right. You're looking well. How are you keeping busy? What are the headlines in your world right now?
Oh, I think everyone's is the same. Everything's just about the coronavirus. Every day you're looking for new updates, hoping, praying that schooling goes back. This homeschooling has been, it's a tough gig. Gee, it's a tough gig. So I'm just trying to keep busy. I've got a gym downstairs, so I use that as often as I can. I think everyone's the same. You just try and make it work. No one does the right thing, but you're just trying to get through.
You've put a bit of time in on the hair as well. Is that just to look good, play good?
No, I didn't put a lot of time in. There's not much hair there, but Curtly Beale nominated me for one of the challenges. All those challenges were going around, and I got nominated for a few and I left them, and then I thought this one would catch on, so I did it. And then as soon as I nominated Drew said, no, I can't do it. I've got TV. So I died.
I love it. How is Drew? Is he well? Are you two still? I mean, he's in America at the moment, isn't he? Is that right?
No, he's not. He was supposed to go.
He was going to go over there.
Yeah. So I think when he got his visa, the borders got shut. And then from there, he's just been waiting, training. I think it's pretty tough for him because single bloke, he can't get out. He can't do much.
Has he still got it in his training? I mean, who's he going to play for? Is he in New York? Is that right? Or am I making this up?
No, New York. Yeah.
And has he still got it? I mean, is he showing himself to be in good condition in the home training?
He always has it. For me, I think he's always got it. No, he's looking good. He's trained pretty hard. I think just the weekend lets him down. Monday to Friday, he's good. Saturday, Sunday, I reckon, like everyone. Brings you undone.
That is very true. And what's happening with your career? Are you done? Did I see something the other day that you've packed up, or are you going to have one more blast because you haven't had the farewell?
No, I'm not after the farewell. I'm done in Japan. So for the moment, I'm just training, and I'm not sure. So Huey Edmonds, who's running a local team here with East Rugby, he's asked me to play. So worst case or best case, I'll be playing local footy. But just, Japan for me, I loved it. It was great. But I think 3 years was enough because I do it without the kids. So you're over there, you train, you play, but when you come home, like your day's off, the stuff where you like to explore and get out, you're kind of by yourself. So it just got, by the end of the 3 years, I mean, it was getting a bit long.
Am I right to say you were known as the million-dollar kid when you came along? You're now the billion-yen sort of mature, elder statesman.
Yeah. I saw an article, could have been a couple of days ago, that was saying that myself and DC were getting £1.1 million for the season.
That's good work, yeah.
Well, I didn't see that. A lot of these.
Have you sent off another invoice?
Yeah, I said to my agent, I said, "This, didn't you take 50% here?" Oh no, sorry, 70%. But it's like, I mean, all those articles and things about what they think players are getting paid. It's all bullshit in the end, really. I saw one about DC that he signed in New York. He actually came out and publicly just said, "No, look, you're making this up."
Never like the media to chuck a couple of barbs at them and see what happens. Giz, it's very, very nice to have you on. And there are so many things that we're going to talk about. I just want to very quickly reflect with Hask and Lord on last week's show because they both did a bit of homework and rewrote Rugby Union from top to bottom. I just wondered if you'd had any feedback, you two, and whether you'd had, Gus Pichot saying, come and be in my gang, or Sir Bill saying, do you want to come and run the game alongside, or whether no one paid any interest.
I saw a few things that from people, obviously just random punters, that were quite positive. And then I said to you that the head of governance and procedures side wanted to link in with me from Premiership Rugby League. So I thought I was going to the top. So look, I think from it, there's obviously been a few things written as well. And it'd be quite interesting to get Git's point of view of what he would do around Australian rugby. Because I read something the other day about whether it'd be worthwhile just going back to individual countries rather than having the Super 14, which would then lead to that World Club thing, would work better. And could Australia run a sustained competition through all the clubs in the country that would actually get as much support as doing all the jet setting around the New Zealand and South Africa, Japan and Argentina. But that side of mine probably could be tweaked. But I think it was well received.
Yeah, I think it was well received. Ask, did your fag packet get any pickup?
No, sorry. It was just my wife's asked if I need a heater in my extensive conservatory area in the fortress of solitude. Now, do you know what? Normally, I kind of get inundated with kind of feedback, but I've had absolutely nothing about anything. So I mean, obviously, every time I ever try to be serious, no one gives a shit anyway. So I think that they probably, and also, I mean, basically, I've been dining out in your comment. Yes, you wouldn't have seen this last time, but Alex, when I did my homework and delivered it, Alex, at the end of the show, went, well, that was actually great. You know, even Hask, with his limitations, did very well. So I've been... and I said that to my wife. My wife went, she went, we all laughed. We had a laugh, like, Alex, ha, ha, ha. And she went, what does he think your limitations are? And I was like, babe, don't they want to go there? They could be extensive.
There's a whole show in that.
There is, but I was... So I've had no feedback at all. I'm not sure anyone's listening. But at the end of the day, as long as someone pays me for a fucking hour a week where I get to shout at people and say what I want, it's the perfect dream.
Did you love your time in France? I mean, it went so well on the field, but did you feel quite at home in the sunshine with your bank balance rocketing, with a view of the sea, playing with the best team in the world? I mean, did that fit comfortably with you?
Yeah, except for the money. So when I first went over there, I was no longer playing international rugby, so I couldn't really ask for much. But even now, looking back at photos and holidays that we went, like as a family, or just winning those games, like the team we had, the fun we had, like away from the field, because we knew we could relax on the weekend, because by the time Wednesday, Thursday came, these experienced guys would just aim up and do their job. And like in the end, it was enough. And Toulon, I mean, Tins knows what it's like, Hass knows what it's like. Even you've been there, but it's a good spot.
With Bernard Laporte, I never know whether he's a good coach or not, because the stuff I heard from Toulon, obviously he had an unbelievable team at that point, but he just basically sat back and let you do it. And the only time you actually really heard from him was when if you lost a game, then he'd come and shout at you and then leave you to fix it. Because you had so many players, did you basically run that team yourself?
Bit of like both. So I think he rode the French players pretty hard. Like in front of a video session, they miss a tackle, he'll say, replay. Then everyone will watch the missed tackle, replay. You just keep going for maybe 15 tackles, and each time you're just sinking into your chair, just like wanting to move on. But after we played a game at Toulon and we lost at home, which is a bad thing. In France, if you lose at home, it's pretty big. Johnny was rested for that game. It was supposed to be an easy game. And Bernard's come in and just singled me out. He said, we'll never win anything if we've got you in our side. You can't tackle. You can't kick. No wonder Australia never picked you again. And he walked out. I was sitting there going, shit. I don't know what's good. I've heard how they just tear your contracts up.
Yeah.
And then my mate just said, come with us. We'll just go to La Plage, which is like the local nightclub.
Nice.
Yeah, I said, I can't really be seen there. Like the public, if they see you out, they think that you're not wearing that loss bad. They'll ride you for a long time. So anyway, he eventually convinced me to go around. I went to La Plage. As I've walked in, Bernard's there with a tie around his head. I don't know. He's just like a guy that, like, he really is passionate for that moment. It's done, and then he lets it go. And for me, I like that. I love hard coaches. You worry about football. Okay, now we're at the nightclub. It's all over. Like, don't worry about it. Just enjoy yourself. We'll worry about it Monday.
Gloucester went there, one sort of pre-season tour, and we had quite a good first 15. Gloucester, we went down and we sort of mixed it up for sort of 60 minutes, but it was all about rotation. There was unlimited subs. We brought on all these 18, 19, 20-year-olds. We had like 10 on the bench, and literally Toulon had 10 internationals on the bench and they ended up putting 60 on us in the last 20 minutes. And these kids were just going, like chasing shadows, going, who dis? who dat? From the, where did that come from? As they were just running in tries with that. But then we had a good night out with those boys because it was, because obviously it was so international as well. It was just good to catch up with. I even got to catch up with Wilco, which is unheard of. It's like catching up with Scarlet Pimpernel.
Even I didn't do that.
did you? Because obviously playing at Stade and like playing against you guys and then seeing back at Warston coming over and playing, did you appreciate at the time how like you almost had that perfect synergy between other international players that were so professional but obviously good French players, and that you were actually, for the first time, everyone was kind of steering the ship? Because one of the things I've always found is that, say for example, when you go to Japan, they get a foreign coach, sacks all the Japanese, and then they try and play a foreign way. That fails. The next 3 years is all Japanese until they go around the cycle. Same thing in France. They get a foreign coach in. He upsets all the French. The French then get upset and they go full French. But in that period of like 3 years, 4 years, you kind of had the perfect synergy. Were you aware of that at the time?
Not really. I think the lucky thing, well, the thing that Mourad probably did best was that he recruited guys at the end of their international career that still wanted to win. So they weren't just cashing in. They still wanted to win competitions, which is pretty rare. A lot of guys, when you recruit a lot of internationals hoping to buy a star team, you might get a couple of good performances, but you don't necessarily get a team that really wants to work for each other. When I signed there, I didn't think that we're going to win competitions. For me, I signed there because I had a mate playing at Toulon and it was a good part of France and I wanted to experience something different.
Can I, there's so many things, so many threads to pick up on, but Are you very close to your dad? And I suppose having run on parallel tracks, the league and the union sort of career that he enjoyed and you've enjoyed, is that, have you had the odd arm wrestle over that? Would he love you to have played league? Is he proud of it, all that you've done in union? Is that an interesting debating point between the two of you?
No, he thinks union's soft. Like still now, I think my whole family play league. They think union's soft, which is fine for me, but I think there was one time, I think it was 2015, when I was coming off contract, 2005, coming off contract, and the Tigers called Dad up and they said, we're thinking we want to sign your son. And he said, well, how much money have you got? He didn't even tell me what the offer was, but he said to him, you aren't even close. And he just hung up. And then that was it, like league was done. He never wanted me really to play it, I don't think. But I think it's probably the sport that we all watch as a family. I prefer to watch that than rugby.
Was that because your big sister did? Because she plays both, doesn't she? So is she closer to your dad because she plays Aussie Rugby League?
favorite child.
Yeah. No, they love him. I wouldn't be the favorite. Definitely not. I'm the only one that didn't play league. I mean, it is what it is. It's a sport I love, like I said, but it just never happened for me. So I've been pretty happy with rugby.
I find it watching the league, because when I obviously been over to Australia quite a few times and I read Andrew John's autobiography and we watched the footy show and stuff, like obviously in Australia, like it is seen as the toughest sport by far, isn't it? It's like it's played by real men who, like, your arms falling off, your legs falling off, and they just go back on. Everyone's scrapping. Like, it's a sport. When I go over to Australia, it's what I watch over union. So I can understand. It's mad over there, isn't it? It's like part of the DNA of being Australians is the league.
I think if you get knocked out, like, and you go off and you're done for a HIA, they're like, oh, this, he shouldn't be paid, this guy. You know, like, I think, but I even think that way when I watch league, whereas if I see a rugby guy get a head knock, oh, gee, he should come off. It's just the mentality. Like, league is, they get around, they drink their beers, they're at a pub. Rugby, we have our red wines and our quiet nights. Yeah. It's just the way
rose,
it is.
A little rosé, extra ice.
Yeah. It's just the way it is.
I'll never forget the Sam Burgess interview as he walked off at halftime in the grand final. And I think it was Joey John said, his cheek had like properly imploded. He said, your cheek, is your right? He goes, no, mate, it's fucked. And just ran off. You wouldn't necessarily get that on BT Sport. But your brother-in-law's, he's a big Aussie Rules as well. Is it Lance Franklin? I mean, you've got some proper strong genes in the family line.
Yeah, that's actually who my son wants to be now, which is disheartening. He always wants to talk, you know, with Buddy or kick a footy with him. So, yeah, I mean, even my wife, she played netball. So I think sport's just a big thing for us, which is good, especially now with this homeschooling. So to get the kids out and kick a footy or do something that I enjoy and they enjoy, it's good. But Yeah, he's a big deal here.
You want to start worrying if your wife wants to go and play with Buddy, then you've got a few problems.
Yeah, she starts calling me Buddy in the middle of the night.
I've got to go kick with Buddy. You can't catch, babe. I've got to go. Kids want to see him.
There's a lot of confusion because Drew Mitchell is also your stepfather to the children, isn't he? We were having a holiday in France and we had this place. Huey was there and we said, oh, why don't you come up? So Drew came up and he brought Gitz's family with him. I was like, well, where's Gitz? Oh, it doesn't matter. So he's like a step-in dad when Gitz is away.
My second boy looks nothing like me and everything like Drew. Drew was injured for a long period, like in the maybe third year, and I'd call my wife, FaceTime home, and she'd have a cocktail glass. I said, what are you having cocktails by yourself? She just turns the glass, Drew's turned the camera. Drew's just made his way up to have a drink with her.
But mate, wasn't wearing your clothes, was he?
I don't know. But
he had his slippers on and was smoking a pipe.
Just nodding. I knew what was going on.
The other thing I wanted to pick up on your Toulon days, and it was very much you and Drew, sort of with Uncle J-Bear at the top, and just your relationship with Johnny. I think it's fair to say you and Johnny are peas from different pods, and yet there's quite a tight bond there. I mean, what did you make of one of the guys who is an English national icon? How well did you guys get on, and what was it like playing with him?
Oh, it was unreal to play with him. I think before I went there, in Australia, because of the time zones, you don't see much of like Six Nations or European rugby, really, unless you're searching for it. And I would often like to watch league, but you get to the World Cups. I remember 2007 and Johnny, obviously 2003, was kicking the goals, and all the highlights that I ever saw was just him kicking. I didn't think he was much of a player. And 2007, when they beat us in Marseille, there was one chance in the 22 where he got out and he tried to run. I think played to Paul Sackey, could have been the winger then. And it was too flat and it went out. And I said, yeah, that's right, mate. Just kick it. That's all you can do. You shit at anything else. And then I just ran off. I remember reading in his book about some Aussie smartass. All he ever said was about him needing to kick. And he was like, well, that's all I need to do. And that's all he did do to beat us. But going to Toulon, I knew he was such a king and he was so good, but I probably underestimated how tough he was as a player, the skill set that he did have, and just the way he could control and run a game plan. Like, for me, it was perfect because I'll probably play a little bit more like what I see in front of me. If I've got to follow a game plan for 80 minutes, mentally, for me, I find it a bit of a battle, whereas that was Johnny's bread and butter. So for me, once we could trust each other and he could trust my calls, things started to fall, you know, into place really well.
That's a big thing about Wilco. If Wilco trusts the players around him, he's a completely different player. If he doesn't trust the players around him, I've played in games for England and other games where he doesn't, and he'll take it all on his own shoulders because then he feels it's all his responsibility. But that Toulon team, where you could see people say, oh, he's playing the best rugby because he's in the sun, and this, it's because of the players around him. He had 100% trust that they would do the job. That's why it worked so perfectly. Well, what I thought it worked so perfectly for them.
I think the first time I got there, he probably didn't. It's not that, because he's such a nice guy and he does, like, he's just so approachable and friendly with everyone. But I think once you get on the field, he worries so much about every decision and about someone judging what he did was wrong and not playing the perfect game. He'll even say it now. It probably limited him, you know, in him actually expressing himself. But the first, could have been maybe the third game in, I saw the back left corner was free and I was outside of him and I said, back left corner to kick. But the phase before, he'd seen that the winger was up on the right side. So he caught it and then he just kicked to that right angle, back to the right side, and the wingers caught it. But in that phase, the winger had obviously readjusted. And then I noticed as time went, the calls that I'd give him, play wide, not kick it long, starting to work for him, I could feel that I was starting to get his trust a little bit more. You know, as Tin said, like, his game just goes to another level because he doesn't have to worry about everything outside him. He can just worry about controlling the game, which he's so good at.
Amazing. Hask, how did you find play? Because you would have been a young one coming through. Did he have the aura when you were up on the rails?
You wouldn't have known from my skill set playing, but I used to spend a lot of time with Johnny, like doing extras after training all the time. But he was brilliant. Like, he was someone that, you know, like when you're in a team, obviously people have an aura about them, but you don't as players, you're obviously respectful, but you don't like play up to that aura. You don't try and, you know, make it awkward. So I would just bust it straight in. It was like, Wilco, you know, start giving him shit. Like, you know, and I said to him, listen, I said to him, look, I'd love to improve this. Can I improve that? Can I do this? And he would really help me. And we'd spend lots and lots of time together doing that extra work. And I was kind of in awe of his work ethic. But I was always very surprised because it was very clear to see that I don't think he necessarily enjoyed most of what he was doing, or he was in his own head a lot of the time. And, you know, he would always train so hard in the week that I would sort of, you know, speak to him, say, Johnny, you know, like, do you ever get into games, start, you know, not feeling that fresh? Because he'd flog himself every day. Yeah. And then you turn up tired. And it was something that I did early, sort of in the middle of my career. You know, I was going to see Margot Wells. I was doing wrestling to help my tackling. I was doing extra fitness. I was doing mobility. I was doing everything. By the time I was getting to the game, I was absolutely fucked. And someone took me to one side and went, you know, all the training in the week, all the stuff, all the weight you lift, everything, doesn't matter if you don't get it right on the weekend. Nobody cares. You don't win anything for training really hard. And it was like, Christ, I know it's such a simple thing to say, but it kind of dawned on me. It was only about 4 years ago, Johnny and I were at a wedding together, and I took him to one side, and we're having a really good catch-up. And I said to him, look, be honest with you, did you actually enjoy, because he's been much more vocal in the recent years about kind of mental health issues, and I said, did you enjoy it? And he said, you know what, I enjoyed whistle at the start of a game, and I enjoyed the whistle at the end of the game, everything else, not really. And was really kind of open about that mentality, saying that he didn't really enjoy it. And that's what I always found hard, because I found him so talented, so hardworking. But you could clearly see that he just wore everything. And that's what I was going to ask Matt, but he's kind of answered it. Did he notice that he was so intense? Because I would have, you know, obviously they thrived over there, but I could just see a lot of the time he was in his head so much that, you know, that his career's gone so quickly. Did he ever look back and say, do you know what? I was top of the world for such a long period of time. I really did enjoy it, because I don't think he did for a large part.
No, he didn't. I would even tell him, like on, say, captain's run, he's still flogging himself. I said, Johnny, you need to rest. Like, you don't need to be doing this much. Have you ever been into a game fresh? And he said, I can't, because if I don't put the work in mentally, I'm going to be doing things like at 70%, 80%, because I haven't done my 20 drop kicks or my 50 goal kicks or kick for the line. Like, every little skill he needed to tick off in his mind so that he knew he could do it at 100%.
He's addicted to process. That is how he divides his mind up, is he has to. I was his kicking partner for all through the early 2000s. And, you know, you're staying two and a half hours. I would stop, but I'd still have to wait for him to finish. And he'd always finish. If he didn't hit 20, what he called zeros or arrows on his drop punts, he goes back to the start and he starts again. Then once he's done his 20 on his right, he does 20 on the left. If he doesn't hit 20 in a row, he starts again. It was just mindless how dedicated and how he couldn't get bored of it. And just repeating that process over and over.
Did you ever manage to drag him into one of your Sunday pit sessions and get him with a cigar in his wife fronts and a stubby? Or was that a push too far?
Is that to me or to Gitz?
Well, to me. I don't have cigars.
Right. I've said to Johnny, when he had his testimonial and everything, and he had like Martin Johnson on stage and Clive, I'm like, why have you got those on stage? They're not going to tell you anything good about you. And I said, get me a Bolsh on stage, under 18s tour to Australia. Great, some great stories about you. Got great stories about you from the early 2000s. He goes, that's why you're not allowed on stage.
I once started a story about the Spice Girls, and he didn't want that being told at all. That was shut down very quickly.
Obviously, I've played with him at 18, Schoolboys. We went on that tour, and it was quite a loose tour. We had some great lads on there, Andy Beattie, Bolsh, Dave Flatman, Lee Mears. As you do, it's a schoolboy tour, first time in Australia, 18 years old. You're billeted. You're getting in amongst it. You are going out and exploring the world. You're in, like, Toowoomba. You're in Darwin. You're going and experiencing everything you can possibly see. And then, obviously, we came back, and in that 98, he immediately got his first captaincy off the bench as wing.
Yeah.
And then we all sort of caught up in 2000s and finally got capped and caught up with him. And through that period, he would go out after every international with everyone, would have a whale of a time, great thing. And I don't know if he said it in his book, but it was the cinema in like 2001 where suddenly he just went, he did that advert with David Beckham and he just went, bang. From then, he said he went to the cinema and he noticed everyone noticing the fact that he was at the cinema. That completely changed him and he just stopped going out. And then that's probably a lot more where his obsessive kind. Obviously, he was obsessed from the start because he had Dave Allred since he was 16. So he knew that there was a lot to build on. But I think that's where That's where the good stories that I've got finished, I think.
But, one for another day. One for another day. Matt, can we go back to the start of your career? And we're talking about sort of people who had it all on their shoulders at an early age in terms of Johnny. That was exactly the same with you as well. What do you remember of, I suppose, breaking through the expectation, the pressure, and being part of what was, I mean, arguably one of the finest Super Rugby teams in that ACT Brumbies outfit that did the back-to-back titles?
When you're young, I don't really think about the pressure. So I didn't even have a Super Rugby contract. So no Super Rugby team was scouting me. It's just Eddie saw me train for the Aussie Sevens one day and Eddie Jones just came down and told the coach, he said, I like the way he trains. And I can't even remember what we did or what I did. But off the back of that, I got picked on a Wallaby tour. Like, it was weird, really strange. So I didn't even know guys from my state. So I'm meeting everyone for the first time, just nervous, like 19, no money. You got to pretend like you got money because they've all got money. But from a football point of view, I didn't have time to think that it wasn't normal. Like, I was picked for a team, so I got to play, and my first cap was against England. At the time, Eddie Jones had a system for your plus and minus, a good pass, plus a missed tackle, minus, good kick, bad kick. I'm the only player to finish in the minuses. I think after 10 minutes, I was minus four or something. Yeah, I think that was kind of the big wake-up call for me when I got my first test. I was like, shit, like, this isn't my level. Like, I'm not at this level yet. And as soon as the tour finished, most players get a holiday, but Eddie sent me straight back to Super Rugby. So then I had to sign for the Brumbies because I was in Canberra, and, yeah, I was just lucky that I was in a good team.
Was it old Eddie? Because obviously there's, like, old Eddie. There's that ruthless, like, stink eye, will fucking kill you, Eddie. And then there's the new Eddie that we see where he doesn't kill anyone. Was that old Eddie?
I see Eddie in Suntory. He'll come to Suntory when I was there. I still get old Eddie. He sees me as that 19-year-old. Get away, mate. And I'm just like, shit, how do I feel? Do I feel good? Do I feel bad? I don't know how I feel.
Because you know if you said, if you said to you, if you went, Gits, how are you, mate? And you went, oh, I'm a bit tired. Fuck's wrong with you, mate?
We don't want tired
people.
Mate.
Tired, yeah. Mate. You don't want tired people. Go home if you're tired.
And if you say, I feel good, oh, you're not training hard enough, mate. It's like, fuck. What do I do? Yeah, he's the only one still now.
Inside your head. Do you do quite a good impression of Eddie?
Oh, I've been known to do not a bad Eddie.
Have you ever used it in a broader context beyond just an ale around a fire pit?
Did one for Rugby Pass about my 21st when he was telling me. So he pulled me aside and he said, Gits, I know it's your 21st, mate, but you're not to drink. We're in the middle of World Cup prep. And I said, yep, no worries. Like, I don't care. Like, I don't want to drink. Doesn't worry me. Like, I'm here for the team. And then they put on a big cake and a big do that night. And the boys can't say, you want a beer? I said, no, that's all right. Like, we've got training tomorrow. He goes, Gits, have a beer, mate. Be with your friends, mate. Relax. So I'm just going, what do I do here? Like, he just told me at training not to have a beer. I said, look, no, it's fine. Like, I won't have a beer. And then Eddie just goes, get him a beer, mate. He'll have a beer. So he got me a beer, put it down in front of me. And I was just like, what am I doing here? Is this like a test if I'm going to be in? But he would constantly, like, just use that stuff, like, always with me. Like, at training, oh, Gits, fucking nice pass, mate, great pass. But then as soon as everyone would leave, he said, got to work on your tackling, mate, not good enough. So, like, everyone would think I'm this pin-up boy, but he would ride me, like, all the time, send me a message, have you been doing this, are you doing that? But in front of everyone else, it looked like I was this pin-up boy. Even now, like, my heart races when I think about it. Like, if he walked in this room here, I'd stand up and just give him a chair and say, yeah, mate, talk to the boys here.
Unbelievable. Did he get the best out of you by doing that, or do you feel that the indecision and the questions sometimes hampered you?
No, definitely. He got the best out of me, especially as a young age. Like, I was still trying to learn the game. He gave so much information. Like, before this New Zealand test, I didn't even know I did it, but at training I went forward and then cut across and just allowed the defence to chase and Sterling would drift under. He said, that's the line, mate. That's what I want. And I never even thought about it. But going into that game, I just thought about manipulating defenders that way, and it helped our team. Like, he was just really good at the small detail. And when you're a young guy, like, trying to learn the game, he was unreal.
Is that why have fared under old Eddie? Oh. Sorry.
I think he loves Husk. He's the only player that I think he said he likes. Is that true?
Yeah, he did.
I just wonder how Husk would have fared under old Eddie. I mean, it would have been a 2-minute conversation, wouldn't it?
Well, I had a mate that got called, Matt Henjak, got called up, his first Wallaby selection in the squad. And he said, Matt, congratulations. Well done, Matt, you've made the squad. He said, oh, thanks, champ. He's gone, champ? Champ? Do you respect anybody, mate? I'll see you in 2 days. When he got there, it didn't last long. Like that camp, he got flogged. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're nervous, though. I don't know if you're nervous. Like, there's so many. I've tried to call him sir. I don't know. When you talk to him, you panic. He's just gone, champ. He's gone, champ. Didn't work.
What a fuck up, though. What a fuck up. Like, obviously, like, Eddie's got a few nicknames of us, but you're right. As soon as he comes in, I'm like, yes, Mr. Jones, Eddie said, thank you, sir. Thank you. You know, because like, just like you, I get like, you're like, Hess, mate. Oi, you're looking good, mate. Oi, these guys said you're old as fuck, mate. You're looking good, mate. And then I get a text later going, see, Borthers, mate. We need to work on your jumping. You can't fucking jump, mate. I get a text and it'll be like, are we something going, mate? You need to go and speak to Dean, mate. We need to speed you up, mate. You're looking like a fucking cart horse out there. And then I go next day, he goes, good, mate, looking faster. I was like, fucking hell. It's going to be one session. Mate, fast, mate. I love it. It was just like, honestly, because you wanted to always go and improve. Like, you'd honestly, I'd be like that. He'd call me, go, Hess, mate, need to come and see you. Be like, how are you? I'd be like, good. He goes, mate, you can do this. You can do that. Do you know how good you could be? This is what you need to do. This is what you need to do. And I'd be like, yes, sir. And he'd like give you the tools to go and do it. And you go and work on it. But it was always like that tentative because I naturally want to like build a relationship. But you always, I think it's always important to have like, good relationships with coaches and players, but to never step across that mark. For example, calling him fucking champ or I give him a little bit of shit, but not too much shit because you just don't want to accidentally see the back, you know, that, oh, Matt, are you fucking serious?
I mean, it's not, I can tell you from personal experience, and not just players, well, I've done Q&As with him on stage in front of 400 or 500 people. This is when he first came to England, and we did 15 minutes where he gave only one word answers. Which, you know, I'm quite comfortable firing questions at people, but when you've got an audience who want to hear from one of the great coaches, it was just before you won your Grand Slam, one word answers and no more. Do you hear from him now at all? Obviously, you know, he's got a dial-in with Suntory, hasn't he?
Yeah, he still comes out there and, yeah, I still speak to him. He's like, how's the club? How's things going? He doesn't sleep. Like, after they won the Grand Final, George Gregan said he went to see him, both at Suntory. They wanted to go have a drink together. And he said, oh, mate, they're... Have you seen what they're doing in Georgia, mate? Some interesting stuff around the malls. He's going, switch off, enjoy the Grand Final. Like, I just think some guys and coaches in particular are just built one way, but Eddie in particular, he just loves his rugby, like lives for it, and he just really enjoys new things, bouncing with players, and I think he enjoys throwing people off, like yourself or me or whatever.
So you know he's got that little dog, Annie. Right. So like everyone always says, right, oh, you know, Eddie doesn't sleep. He's got a mad work ethic. And it's 100% true. You know, exactly what you said. That's why I always admire people who want to, you know, develop themselves the entire time. So as soon as the tournament's finished, he's looking at other coaches, other players, how can he improve, dismantles the whole setup, you know, looks at different ways of like, even from the way players are eating to how self-reliant they are. But I obviously, a lot of times you get a text message like 4 a.m. So I get up for a piss in the night because I'm getting older. You know, you're weeing like 3 times a night. And you see a text and it's like, I'm not sure I should reply to that because is it a good thing that I'm up at 4 or is it not a good thing? So I'd ignore those. But sometimes he'd go and he'd say he'd been sleeping or he'd been awake all the time, right? And you go and knock on his office door and you knock on it and you just hear this like scuffling noise and then he'd be up and you like 100% he was sleeping in the dog's bed under the desk, 100%. It's the same size as Annie, and he was fucking asleep under there. And you come in, and you'd be like, oh, man, I lost a pencil under the desk. I was like, fuck off, Eddie. You've been asleep in there, mate. Don't, you know, but it's good PR, isn't it? If everyone thinks you never sleep, you never rest, it's a great story.
Right, let's just have a quick break and remind you that you are listening to and watching House of Rugby on Joe, together with our good friends at Guinness, with me, Alex Payne, alongside Haskintons and the rugby legend that is Mr. Matt Giddo. Still to come, we'll dig into a bit more of Toulon, the lows of 2011, highs of 2015. And what is next for the great man, plus, of course, the state of Australian rugby right now. In the meantime, don't forget to check out our House of Rugby Shorts series, which is out every Thursday during the lockdown. 20 minutes of good old-fashioned rugby conversation with a different guest each week. We had Mo Hunt on Fine Form last Thursday, talking about the 2021 World Cup and dishing the dirt on a number of her teammates. But also make sure you download a new podcast from Joe, which is called Sports Pages. And that digs into the stories behind some of the greatest sports books ever written. And episode 2 is out now, talking with John Feinstein, the author of the 1995 William Hill Sports Book of the Year, A good walk spoiled, days and nights on the PGA Tour. Have a listen to this.
I still remember that first morning at the 93 Ryder Cup. There was a two-hour delay because of fog and the greens were still too cold. And finally the matches began and Davis Love and Tom Kite were playing against Seve Ballesteros and Jose Maria Olazabal, arguably the greatest Ryder Cup team in history. And I was following the players toward the first tee. And of course, we were walking through, you know, an alleyway of fans on both sides. And I remember Davis kind of walking back to me and saying, I've never been so scared in my life because the pressure was just so intense. You know, there's a saying among golfers that when you do something wrong, you threw up all over yourself. I had a 6-footer and I threw up, meaning you choked basically. And at that moment, Davis wasn't so much worried about choking. He was worried that he was going to get sick on the fairway in front of millions of people watching on television and watching live because his nerves were just so out of control. It was amazing he was able to draw the club back.
So that was John Feinstein talking about his classic book, A Good Walk Spoiled, in episode 2 of Sports Pages on your podcast apps. And episode 3 is out next Tuesday. Let's get back into it, though. Take us back to those Brumbies days. And you, I mean, you mentioned Sturlo, but also, you know, Gregan, Larkham, George Smith coming through as well. I mean, that was one hell of a team. What are the memories of, I mean, arguably, you know, the greatest Super Rugby team that Australia's had?
Oh, just good memories. It was weird because a year before, I'd go out and have beers and watch them play, like on the hill, and then like give it 3 or 4 months and I'm training with these guys going on end of season tour. Like the whole experience was just surreal. Even now, like Joe Roth was a fullback, Andrew Walker. These are guys that I'm training with every day, helping me with my lines and how to manipulate people. And it was the best school ever. Like it, so for me, it was just, I don't know, I was just lucky, really lucky.
Did you always feel very comfortable at that level? Was it sort of to the manner born, or did you find yourself having to adjust to, you know, World Cup winners all around you and guys who were right at the pinnacle and at the peak of the game?
No, I never feel like I belonged or comfortable for a long time until... Super Rugby probably felt more comfortable earlier because I could string together a couple of good games. But then being able to play kind of dominant role in a test match, I couldn't do for a long time. So, yeah, it took me a while to feel comfortable. Even now when I catch up with, say, George Gregan or Sturlo, I still see these guys as when I was young. So you respect them, you still feel a bit nervous, you want to say the right thing, and then after a few beers you can relax. But for me there's always that first level of respect that you owe them because... Yeah, I don't know. It's just the way I've idolised them, I suppose, being a local here.
Tins, we've spoken a lot about teams that you played against in the past, but what was it that defined playing against Australia when Gitz was in there and Gregan, Larkham? What were those games like and where were you tested in perhaps ways that other countries didn't?
I think what Australia, I've said this before, what they were always amazing at is they always could figure out a game plan that they thought would work against England, and generally it did. Always look at sort of the Institute of Sport as it was back then and how professional they were and how dedicated they were to their craft. And that always sort of was the side that came across to us. But I'd say when I was very lucky that when I started playing Australia, those early years, we didn't actually lose. But you could still see...
That's not true.
For my first few years, then obviously after that it did, but you're still looking at history and the history that came through against England, Australia. It always had a bit of edge, a bit of niggle. They had such world-class players at the time, obviously with Gitz, George, Gregan, Roth, all the people we've been through, Sterling, even before that, with Timmy Horan and people. You know, they were sort of the pinnacle that you were always chasing for us after 99. What I always loved was... Australia, you always enjoyed after the games as well because you would get rinsed. The verbals that were on the pitch were intense, some of the best. But then after the game, every Aussie always wants to have a beer with you and actually get to know you, whereas you can't say the same generally about Kiwis or really South Africans, whereas Aussies will grind you verbally and try and grind you on the pitch. But then after it, you catch up and you make mates, which, I mean, I've got quite a lot of mates who I used to play against for the Aussies, so...
Where does Gitto rate in the verbal bombasts?
Actually, it wasn't really...
I would never talk to him. I remember when I first came in, looking at him, I was just like, just don't make him angry, don't make him angry, just try and tackle him somehow. I wouldn't have said a word.
Mate, Greig's obviously JP, Jeremy Paul, Gobby, you had...
Kefu, Todai Kefu.
Yeah, there was Kefu, but who was the...
Owen Finnegan.
Yeah, literally.
Melon. Was he called Melonhead or something?
Melon.
Yeah, he had a massive melon to refer to him. So it was that side of it, and that's part of the battles that you really enjoy. You enjoy it when there's a bit of verbals there as well. I mean, I didn't really give out loads because I was like, well, I'll just get my job done, and if I do my job and we win, then I'm happy. But there's a lot of people, obviously, like Dawson, that jump into it, Delalio, Backy's all over it. I think that's what makes those games special. It's the same if you, you know, with Wales or anything else. It's when you can get really... It's more than just rugby, and I think that's what England have always had against Australia.
Matt, can I ask you about World Cups? Obviously, it, you know, highs and lows, etc., but you're wearing the wry smile. 03, is there a medal somewhere, or has it all gone in the bin? And what do you remember of the day that
medals with my parents. Obviously, disappointing. I remember just coming on and off because Stephen Larkham got a cut above his chin that just wouldn't close up. So I had to keep subbing on and off for him. So he couldn't get any type of rhythm. I think my first carry, Johnny smashed me, like picked me up, dropped me down. But then my next carry, I bumped him a little bit. And I think he had neck issues at the time. And he was stingy and he was down for a while. And I was thinking, this is great. Like, I'm going to be a hero here. Didn't turn out that way. But after the game, like, I was really disappointed. But it was my first year in international football, first real year, and I thought, this is pretty easy. We've got, like, a good team. We'll get a next chance in 4 years. Then again, quarterfinal, things were going well. We got knocked out by England again. 2011, I didn't make it, and I'm in France. So I just thought, shit, like, you don't really get too many cracks at it.
When it came around again in 2015, I mean, again, it was an amazing story, and then you played some incredible by the final, obviously. But did you treasure 2015 more because of missing out in 2011?
Yeah, massively. Yeah, like 100%. Because also my kids got the opportunity to watch me. They were an age where they still remember now. I could pick them up, walk around the stadium. They saw me playing for my country. They went to some big games, which they remember. So just memories like that were quite special. And I think because I'd been out of the game for 4 years, not that you ever took it for granted, but when you picked week in, week out, even if you weren't playing sometimes well, you kind of just assume it's going to keep happening. But once I was out for 4 years, when I first got picked to play for the Wallabies and you're back representing your country and you see what it means to people, then, yeah, I think I did appreciate it, like, so much more. Not that I ever took it for granted, but I really appreciate it.
Just going back to missing out in 2011, I heard you talk about what Eddie Jones was as a coach. I've heard that sort of Robbie Deans was slightly on the other side of it. You wanted someone who you'd been used to, like Eddie, telling you what you needed to do if you've had a good game, what I need to work on, what's right, what's wrong. Whereas he wasn't that sort of coach. He was more of a want-to-be-your-mate type coach, push you in the right way of always saying you've had a good game, you wouldn't change anything. Did that relationship fall apart on the back of that, or was it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, now I've even seen him in Japan and we're certainly better than we were, and I'd happily have a beer. But I think it just got to the point where I would ask him, even leading into after the Super Rugby, we were playing Samoa, which we lost in Australia. And before the game, I was like, is there anything you want me to focus on, anything you want me to work on? He said, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And then as soon as he told me that, I was thinking, shit, I think I'm on the out of here. And then that was my last test under him. So yeah, it was just, I understood what he was trying to do because he brought in a lot of younger guys and he wanted them to feel comfortable. But the way the Australian rugby had been previously, when I'd come in, the senior guys would show you how to behave and tell you how to behave. Once you're on the field, you knew your role and you just execute that. Once Robbie came in, he wanted everyone on the same peg, on the same level, didn't want us driving standards, wanted us all to be accountable for our own actions, which off field probably we slipped a little bit. But it certainly helped develop the younger guys quicker, but it shifted a lot of guys, especially the older players. We got moved on pretty quick.
Am I right saying you sent a tweet saying, thank you, Bull Boys, thank you, Linesman, that's it, after the, I mean, do you have any, I don't suppose you're someone that looks back with regrets, but do you have regrets that you didn't go? Do you have regrets that you couldn't build the bond with him, or is it just water under the bridge?
No, I don't have regrets I couldn't go because I'd been selected for however many, 10 years before that, even if I hadn't performed. So I understood what he wanted to do and the direction he wanted to take, and that's fine because as a coach, you live and die by your selections. He didn't want me. That was fine. It was just the way it was handled. So I was flown up from Canberra to Sydney to be told that I wasn't there. And like in the corner was one of the staff getting changed. They'd just come back from South Africa. He's taking his pants off. He's in his undies. They're unpacking strapping and everything else. And Robbie's sitting here just saying, we've gone with a 17-13 split. I said, okay. He said, so you're not in. I said, okay. I said, why did you fly me up here then? I said, this is embarrassing. You flew me up here to drop me. He said, no, well, I wanted to do it out of respect. I said, if it's respect, then we get a room. It's just us. So you've got people coming and going. I can't say anything. And then he said, oh, anyway, that's what's happening. I said, can you book me a flight out, please? He says, oh, well, we've got you going tomorrow. And that night was the launch, like all the players getting together in their suits for photos. I said, mate, I want to get out of here. So I then got out of there. And as I was waiting for the taxi to pick me up, I sent that tweet. And I nearly actually got fined for that because I released news before the squad had been picked. So, I mean, that would have been anything. If I got fined for that as well, then that would have left a sour taste in my mouth. But, yeah, I mean, it is what it is, and I'm past it now. Like, I got over it pretty quick. I think it was the best thing for me. I got to go to France and play for Toulon, and, yeah, it turned out to be a bit of a blessing. But, yeah, it was just that period in particular. I didn't handle it well. I didn't act very well. I acted pretty bratty, but it was also just, I don't know, just not, just not a good situation.
And the last hurrah under Cheka, I mean, we've spoken to Hask many times about Cheka. Everything from, what was the song you used to play at training? It wasn't Back in Black, but it was Smoke Over Water or something.
I think, no, TNT, was it?
TNT, that's right, yeah. I mean, it just looked like a lot of fun to be part of that Australian crew in 2015. Hask will disagree, obviously, with the flambé dive in the corner to knock England out. But it just looked like a really good blast.
Yeah, it was good. I think because I appreciated everything, and I could be really open with Cech, because when he brought me back, he said, like, I'm thinking of picking you in the World Cup squad. And I said, I haven't played test footy in 4 years. I don't know if I'm at that level. So each game we review it and say, what do you think? Should I keep pushing or is that it? You're going to pick someone else. And then it only got maybe three games in where I, in the, what was the Four Nations, what is it? The
Rugby Australian Championship or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. It got into that. And I was like, okay, well, it's up to you now. Like, I'm putting myself on selection, and then got picked, and it was just, I was able to be open with him, and it's just a really good dynamic. I've never had that with a national coach where I could say, look, the boys aren't feeling what you're doing. Maybe we need to change this up, just to be a voice for the players, but not have an impact on my selection. It was just a really good time. And except for the last game, we're pretty successful.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose you've achieved so much in the game. Is 2015 the final? Is that an itch that you haven't quite scratched? Or again, is it just, it is what it is kind of thing?
Well, it is what it is. It's an itch that I didn't scratch. Like, I didn't win a World Cup, but I'm not going to win one now. so I think I had two cracks at it, wasn't able to get there. So it is what it is.
It is. It's been an amazing career.
It was interesting because obviously, I know it gets, you know, we've met a couple of times, but it's one of those things where if you're a good person in rugby and as well as obviously a talented player, that kind of filters down. You know, there's like yourself, Drew, there's guys that I would have liked to have played with and obviously met in passing, have always been very good, and you only ever hear good things. It's interesting watching that, the 2015, because that's when you got a concussion, wasn't it? And it's like watching that, and I knew that it was coming to the end of your time in the international. I don't know if you'd announced it already, and it was like, I'm watching it, and I obviously didn't have a vested interest in either side winning. But it's like one of the moments when you see someone that you know is highly regarded and loved and has put so much in to get like a concussion. Even I was sitting on the sideline going, fucking hell. Paul, I remember, I don't know who I was watching it with, Chloe or whatever. I was like, fucking hell, he's dust. He's like, and that was a real kind of for a person not involved. It was a sad thing to see that was, you were kind of robbed by just a really innocuous thing because you weren't able to do what you want to do. And then that's kind of the cruelty of sport. But even me as someone who doesn't know you that well, it was something that kind of touched me like, fucking hell, you wanted to, whether you want it or not, you wanted to have a fair crack at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think the worst thing for me was I remember running off the field and everything was fine. And I was just hanging on the dock. I said, okay, we'll go get this test done. And I go in to speak to the lady. She said, I've seen the footage. We're not going to test you. I said, you've got to, like, please just give me a chance to pass this test. She said, no, like, not even a chance to pass the test. Like, that was the worst part, because if I failed the test, then I failed the test, but at least I would have liked to have an opportunity to do it. And I still remember it now, so I don't think the knock was as bad for my head as maybe it looked. I think at that point in time, I think I tried to get up too quick and I was too dizzy and I was in the All Blacks attacking line, I think, is what the lady was telling me. I haven't looked at it again. But yeah, it was, yeah, I mean, I'm at peace with it. Like, I did everything I could. Like, sport, as you say, it's cruel, but it can be so good at times as well.
So if I could give you keys to time travel and you could go back and play one game again, would it be a day when you felt untouchable on the paddock and you're beating the All Blacks or whatever it might be, or would you go somewhere and right a wrong?
I don't think so. I don't think I'd change too many, because if you change one, it might alter another. I've been pretty, okay. Like, I loved the games that we won, even the losses that you had, you learn a lot. If I could change any game, then probably the World Cup. I'd love to at least have 80 minutes to compete. That would probably be the one thing.
I'm not sure I've ever asked you that, Haskins. If you could do one again, what would it be?
Well, okay, there's a few things I'd change off the field. I'm not sure I'd change too many.
We haven't got enough time. We haven't got enough time for you to redact.
I think I'm in the same boat as that, Hask.
Good. Right, that is what this show is all about.
You can tell Gitz is a man who, like, obviously has watched a few movies on time travel and shit, like talking about the butterfly effect. It's like, even he doesn't want to, like, go, oh, if I change one thing, it might mean I might never play again or the world could end. Oh, you're a secret geek. I like that. You revealed yourself as a secret geek unwittingly there. I don't know. I don't think I would. There's a few things where, you know, I was spoilt in like early career with WASC. You know, I was talking to a few people about it the other day, you know, to win, to go to those finals, to win, you know, Heineken Cup, win a premiership at 21, to win lots of things and kind of be spoiled and then not get to a final again until the premiership final with WASC. I think if I could change anything to win the premiership final with WASCs again, would have been good, you know, because up until 10 minutes ago, 5 minutes ago, we were in the lead to beat Exeter. And, you know, a boy gave away a penalty. We then went into extra time. Then it became a battle. And, our scrum get folded up and we lost off a kick off the scrum. You know, and especially my views on scrums, I don't give a shit about scrums. And I can't be... I hate them. And the fact that they decide games is very frustrating. So I think if I could probably change one thing, it would be to win that premiership final. Just because it would have been nice to have gone back and done something and to tasted success again when I was spoilt so young with it.
Yeah, I reckon when you're older, you appreciate those successes a lot more. Like that first one that I won with the Brumbies, like, to me, just seemed like this is what happens. And then you go a long period without it, and it's like, you really, when you're older, like, it means so much more. Did Georgie Smith, was he in that team?
Was George Smith in that one? I can't remember, but what a boy. Oh, mate, someone, oh, my God. I honestly, I didn't know what to expect, because he's another one that I like, idolized as a player. I didn't quite realize how good he was because I'd missed him on the international circuit. He'd moved around and then I'd obviously watched him. And he's a player that I would ask the video analysis guy to send me clips of him, breakdown work, tackling work, whatever. So I watched it and I met him. And mate, what a machine. The best bit was is that he was A, lovely, I think slightly mad, would absolutely turn up, destroy it, disappear, come in on a Monday, like stinking a piss, and you'd be like, oh my God, like, what has this man done? And he'd go away and he'd had one of those training masks. He just put a training mask on, sit in the gym and just sweat it out, like screaming as demons into this mask. And then it'd be fine because he just never got injured. Like, he was like invincible. And also to learn from, like, the skills, the technique, the smoothness of his movement, the way he conducted things. I loved his confidence, you know, like, he'd just stand up at 10, start putting people through holes. You'd be like, the fuck are you doing, George?
He was the one player that Eddie didn't try and change. So he knew that he liked to drink. So Eddie just said to him, he said, George, your decision, mate. You're either going to stop drinking, because his weight was his skin folds was a bit of a battle. They said, you've got a choice, mate. You can stop drinking and then you just be professional and do everything. Or on Monday you come in, you do your extras and you work hard, mate. And George, trying to do the right thing, said, oh, I'll stop drinking. He said, wrong answer, mate. And he just knew straight away. And to his credit, that's exactly what George does. He'd play a game, play awesome, belt himself that night. Next day, he's in flogging himself with that mask.
I think for me, of all the players I played with, I was lucky to play with some amazing back row, you know, Lawrence Dalio, Joe Worsley, to name a few. But then I idolised Rich McCaw. But as like an all-round good bloke, I think George is a fantastic bloke. But such a quality player. For me, when I look back at all the players I've probably played with, and I forget to say it, you know, you get that standard nausey question, who's the best player you've ever played with or against? And I think George has got to be right up there, just all right at the very top, because he just did things in such an effortless way, but was always so relentless, yet, you know, when you took his shirt off, he just looked like a little builder. But then he was it was unbelievable. And would always give up his time. That was the weird thing, you know, like he, I mean, I joked about it because the first like 2 months being there, I go, George, sorry, I just wondered if I could just Google some video stuff. He'd be like, yeah, mate, yeah. And then you just fucking see him running to the car park. And people be going, how has George really affected your game? And I was like, I can't get him in a room on his own. He won't spend any time with me. He keeps ignoring me. So I eventually like pinned him down after training. And every day I'd be like, George, what are we doing today? And he'd be like, okay, mate. And then, you know, he would help me out. But it was quite funny. He was trying to avoid me, I think.
You tucked in some quite good hairdos over the years as well, Matt. But did you ever go for the dreads? You ever inspired to grow it out?
Oh, definitely inspired to do it. But no, I don't think. Could you imagine if I rocked up?
I'm trying to. Which was the best of the lids you went with? I mean, it was never quite Beckham levels, but there were some fairly flamboyant ones in there.
The problem was I had a sponsorship here in Canberra where a lady would just keep doing my hair up and I'd go in and she started getting creative with like Chinese letters, like writing winning and all this type of stuff in the side of my head, which when you look back at it now, it's incredibly cringe. But at the time I thought, like, how mad is this?
It's got to be done.
Mate, I've been there with that. So obviously when I had a bit more of an extensive lid, there wasn't one slipping off the back. I started to go and see Danny Kerr and I used to go like midweek to this naughty barbers in, where the hell, in Kingston or somewhere like that, right? And we used to go to the old High and Tight, you know, like 0.5 and everything else. And obviously because these blokes are a bit fruity, he was like, do you want a lightning bolt? I was like, yeah, I'm a public school boy. I'm fucking, of course I want a lightning bolt. Put a lightning bolt on me. So he put a lightning bolt, rolling with a lightning bolt. All the backs are like, yeah, Hask. I think they were probably just winding me up like that, trying to egg me on. So we went in there. We went in there the next time. And they were like, I tell you what, mate, do you want to get a hashtag in the side of your head? I was like, fucking yes. Of course I do. Hashtag me, bro. So he like puts like a hashtag in my head. And I'm like rolling along. Chris Ashton's filming it. Danny Kerr. Everyone's high-fiving. And I'm like, this is brilliant. I've got a hashtag. And then... obviously, Stuart Lancaster was coach, right? And can you imagine that he wants his player, especially a gobshite like me, with a hashtag in his hair? So as I've got closer and closer to Pennyhill Park from London, it's dawned on me that I'm about to roll in with a guy that doesn't really approve of anything showy, and I'm rolling with a 0.5 with a hashtag in the side. So I've gone back to my room and I've gone, Doz in the tea. I was like, Doz, best. I was like, mate, get the clippers out. He's like, what? I said, okay, you got to shave this out. You got to shave this out. He goes, you're going to have a bald spot, bro. I said, fuck it, get it out. So he shaved a bald spot in the side of my head. So I've rolled into the meeting, right? And obviously Danny Kerr and Chris Ashton have told everybody that I've got a hashtag, right? And I've come in, I've got a bald spot, and I was like, lads, don't lie. You know what happened? The clipper slipped and the blit came off. And you could see Stuart Lancaster the whole time in the meeting, trying to like look around the side of my head to see if it was true. And like Graham Rowntree came up to me, was like, what's going on, Hass? I said, listen, mate, went to the barber's, clipper fell off, it's awkward. He went, you didn't get a hashtag, did you? And I was like, no hashtag. So that was my one bit of risque hair, and that's fallen out, so I just can't do it anymore.
Oh, you'd be able to hashtag the hair now. listen, the other thing that I'd love to ask you about is what the hell is going on in Australian rugby right now?
Yeah, it's. I think there's a lot of people that have come out talking negatively about it, but there's never been real positive chat around the community, and especially, you know, when I come back from Japan, you just notice the negative tone around rugby. So what you guys were talking about earlier, like at the very start, I think that would be a great thing for Australia if it just went Australia-based. Get the crowds back, get people actually passionate about their area and supporting their area. So I think that's missing a little bit from Australian rugby, and the grassroots now is it's just not a popular sport. So even my kids, they don't like rugby. Like they don't see it on TV that much. Like they want to play AFL or rugby league. So it's just, yeah, I think they need to get the grassroots right, get it popular again, and just start in Australia.
What does club footy look like at the moment? Obviously, everyone always talks about Randwick sides of the past and those, but then what is club footy like in Canberra? What is it like in Queensland? What is it like? Would there be a passion for it if you did get it back there? Because obviously... you look at South Africa, they run the Currie Cup. You look at New Zealand, they run their, whatever it's called now, it used to be Air New Zealand, whatever it is now.
NPC.
They run their NPC. But Australia doesn't have that. Is it just basics to actually get one of those cups up and running again and try and get people to understand what, not how good rugby union is just on the field, but what it does for a community off it?
Yeah, well, I think Canberra, for example, when we used to have a club team, the Canberra Vikings, they would compete against your Randwick, Sydney Unis. So it wouldn't change the club competition. It might actually, it might strengthen the club competition because they want to play for this rep Canberra team, the Canberra Vikings. So at the moment, there's no real pathway because I think the Brumbies have a lot of players outside of Canberra. There's not really that natural pathway through to the Brumbies like when I was here. So I think from a club point of view, you'd get, say, three teams or two teams in Brisbane or in Queensland. You'd have your five from Sydney, your one from Canberra, maybe you got your one in WA, and start to build it that way. Almost like they had an NRC a few years ago.
Yeah.
But there were five teams or six teams, I think, and I think they lost $4 million in the first year and they just gave up on it. I think the next year maybe lost a couple million again and it was just too much for the AU to lose. So I don't know how it works from a business point of view or how it would look, but I think for Australian rugby and to get it popular and the people supporting it again, we need to bring it back to just your local team, not your local teams, but your representative teams in that area.
We've spoken a lot on this show about just how rivalry drives interest. You know, I think Super Rugby, when it came along, was amazing. It was razzmatazz. But now, you know, the Lions against whoever it is, you know, the Reds in the middle of nowhere with no one in the stadium, inconvenient time of day, just doesn't work for anybody. And yeah. I think your point about rivalry would be a thing. What is going to happen, do you think? I mean, Raylene Castle resigned last week. There's been a lot of hoo-ha about the letter from the captains. You know, is there going to be peace at any point, or is it... has it got to fall apart further in order for a sort of comeback to start?
I don't read too much of the media. I don't like to follow it too much because there's so much negativity around rugby, especially in Australia. So I like to just leave it, and any individual players, like any local boys around here, I'm happy to help and I talk to them and see how they're going personally. But as far as the business and the AAU and the board, how they're going to move forward, I don't know. But I care too much about rugby and Australia to really feed into that negativity and follow it too much. So I'm probably not that well educated on the issues with it. So I just leave it. And I think if they put it back to a local comp, just Australia based. No, look, I'm not trying to pass the buck, but I really...
No, I just missed one. I wasn't saying you're passing the buck. It's just like, I completely get it. Up here, there are a lot of people who are utterly, utterly sick of the wrangling and the fighting and the squabbling. And every week there's a new governing body that comes out and is arguing with a different governing body. I mean, nothing turns off fans and players and broadcasters like a sport where everybody is backbiting, bitching, fighting for a small piece of cake, and ultimately no one's coming out with any glory.
Well, the thing is, in Australia, you've got so many competing sports too. So you've got your rugby league, AFL, soccer at the same time that are now... past. So if rugby is not popular or it's just got a negative tone about it, then we'll just move on. We'll pick another sport and we'll get into that because there's so many teams wherever you live that you can support.
Are people excited by Dave Rennie, who loves the guitar and the post-match and, you know, everyone in a huddle?
I've heard good things about him. For me, the thing I like most about him is that he's brought coaches that he doesn't know. So you're Scott Wiseman, or who was the forwards coach that he's brought in? Do you know?
talking to the wrong man, isn't it? I don't know how the week it is, mate.
Scott Wiseman, that's a good example.
Yeah.
But a lot of coaches nowadays, they'll bring their little crew, even their media managers, to try and put their spin on things. He's just coming, I think, by himself. He may have a medical staff or something, but to me it shows he's got a lot of confidence in his own ability and he's willing to get the best people around him that's going to make Australia work.
Do you hold promise and hope for the Wallabies, or do you worry about them?
I worry about our game. The way it's trending, I worry that rugby could be dead in the next couple of years. That's my biggest concern in Australia. Because we've got so many other sports, the crowds are getting less and less. Unfortunately, it's taken something as drastic as the coronavirus for this to happen, but it might be a blessing in disguise that we get back to just an Australian-based comp.
God, I tell you what, when someone with your standing in the game ends up talking in those terms, I think a lot of people need to sit up and listen. What about you? What's next on the to-do list, other than obviously quarantining for the foreseeable future? But coaching, media, celebrity come dine with me, Strictly Come maybe, Dancing?
You know what I would like to have a go at? And I think Hass did it as well, that the jungle, celebrity, get me out of here. I just think I like Survivor. Survivor's a great game, but it's too tough for me. I don't think I could handle that. So if I was to do anything, is that one tough, like sleep-wise and...
Do you know what? It's one of those things. If you've been a sportsman and you've gone through a bit of hardship, you've been on a dodgy pre-season camp, you've been with a whole lot of people you've never met before, it's actually not too bad. Like, if you'd asked me, do I like spiders? Do I like bugs? Would I do any of this stuff? I'd be like, absolutely not. Hate them all. You know, if there's a spider in the room, it's going to get dusted. I can't go to bed with it, like, looking at me. Do you know what I mean? But I never watched any of the show, and I watched a bit of, like, the video on the way to the airport to see the challenges. And I was like this, like, gagging, like, trying to pull my headphones out. Like, the driver was like, you're right, sir. I was like, rang my wife up. I was like, babe, you fucking watch this show. Why did you not tell me they're eating, like, live stuff? And I got out there, and do you know what? I found boredom quite difficult because you just... The days are so long. So you wake up when it goes light and you go to bed when it goes dark. And obviously all the food is controlled by them. But the portions of food you had in the day were so hard, mate. Like, you know, I'm not a complainer, but they also, a lot of times in TV, especially the UK version, they think that you're eating, like they said, you're eating 600 to 800 or 2,000 calories. Mate, I put it in my fitness pal. I was getting 89 calories for at least 10 hours a day. And they wonder why I was like feeling faint and dizzy. They're like, you're just dehydrated. I was like, I've drunk 15 bottle canteens of water. And some bloke off EastEnders has had one half a thing. And, you know, he's like passing out upside down. So if you can get around that, it's definitely worth doing and it's nice. But people come out these TV shows and go, it was the greatest thing I've ever done. I discovered so much about myself. Mate, when you've been in a pre-season camp, you know, doing all this kind of stuff, you discover more about yourself doing that than you do. Yeah. Unless, you know, you were doing like a Survivor or you were doing like that SAS Who Dares Wins program. I imagine you find something out about yourself that, not in a jungle. You know, I found out that if you put a spider in my mouth, make me eat a bullseye for some food, I'll fucking do it without even thinking about it. That's the test I found.
If you didn't see it, Matt, Hask went from the nation's darling to the nation's punch bag in the space of 24 hours.
Yeah.
So watch his and then do the opposite and you'll be fine. I still think a little bit of spandex and another hairdo and you and Drewy doing the cha-cha on Strictly would be much better telly. You can take that and run with it.
You could go for a Guinness World Record like Drew. I reckon you could beat him in a 100-meter clog race or whatever.
I got one. By passing him the football, I got half the record when he went for the most drop goals in 3 minutes. He was hitting him like a dog. He only had to hit, I think, 20 in 3 minutes. We only just scraped in.
Unbelievable. I remember you doing that. That was actually on Sky years ago. How many did he get in the end? He got about 4 or 5, didn't he?
Yeah, he got 4 or 5. I think because it was $600 or $1,200 if you want to have a go at the record. And that doesn't necessarily mean... So if you fail once, you've got to pay another $1,200 to go again.
Wow.
So he just strapped those clogs on. I think he crushed as many apples as he could in his biceps. And I think it's... But when you're in France, you just... You feel like no one, like this footage isn't going to go anywhere. Like some of the stuff he did was just ridiculous. He was crying in a nappy one time and it's still haunting him now.
I love that.
And here endeth the show on an image like that. Unbelievable scenes. Matt, it's been an absolute honour, a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming to join us on House of Rugby. Stay well. Look after yourself.
Cheers, kids.
Good luck with the homeschooling. Lots of gaffer tape. That is it for this week. What a hero. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening to House of Rugby, brought to you by Joe, together with our good friends at Guinness. Don't forget, you can dig into our entire back catalogue on podcast or on YouTube, and you can talk about your favourite shows on the Facebook group as well. We've got Rugby Twitter and we've got Rugby Instagram for you to get stuck into as well. Don't forget to download Sports Pages, which is the new interview podcast from iTunes. That's on your podcast app. Thank you to James. Thank you to Tins. But most of all, thank you once again to Matt Giddow. The great Meg Giddo. Stay safe out there, everybody. We'll see you on Thursday with another House of Rugby short. We'll be back on the main show next Tuesday with Ben Youngs. Looking forward to having him on. That's it from all of us. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll speak to you soon.
You've been listening to the House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.co.uk for the facts.